revelation. Okay, let's get down to business. Today is week four of a five-week series that we've been doing on Revelation, and I want to begin today's sermon by making a cultural observation. I don't know if you've noticed, but Jesus is in our culture today. Jesus is cool, right? He's the dude. He's the guy, right? Jesus is all the rage. In fact, most of my friends, whether they are Christian or not, are actually pretty fond of Jesus. They think he's admirable to some degree, or that he lived a life, you know, that's worth following. Like, people like Jesus. At least they tend to. Most of my friends. Okay, have you noticed Jesus is young and he's old? He's millennial and he's boomer and he's Gen Xer. Okay, it's for the middle children. I didn't forget you this time. All right, he's left. He's right. He's liberal. He's conservative. He's Democrat. He's Republican. Or at least he gets pulled to both sides. Poor Jesus. He didn't know who to vote for. Somebody should get on Facebook later today and tell Jesus who to vote for, because nobody's doing that. But Jesus is like, he's Western and he's Eastern. No, he's global. He's rich. He's poor. No, he's middle class. Right? Like Jesus, he's for everybody. He's for, you know, the nerd. He's for the jock. He's for hipsters. He's for people who don't dress like homeless folks. Like, he's for everybody, right? And everybody kind of can get their arms wrapped around something about Jesus. He's in our culture today. Here's the interesting thing, though. While our culture loves Jesus, our culture, well, they don't love his church nearly as much. Have you noticed that? I get in lots of conversations with friends about why they don't come to church, and they say, hey, look, it's not because of Jesus. It's because I've met too many of his followers. And I think there's a disconnect there. There's a disconnect between Jesus and his body. Jesus and the physical manifestation of him in the world today. Us, you, me. The local church. You know what I think? I think the local church today in our culture needs a fresh word from Jesus about how to be the church. Now, you know where you can find that? Perhaps no place better than Revelation. Because in Revelation chapter 2 and in Revelation chapter 3, Jesus speaks, like red letter Jesus here. Jesus speaks to the local church, 7 different local churches located in the province of Asia back then. And he gives them a performance evaluation. He tells them what's going on. He tells them what he thinks. And I think there is so much application for us today. Hey, see, here's what a lot of people forget about Revelation. A lot of people forget that Revelation is the largest collection of Jesus' teachings to the church. And you know why? Because it is the only collection of Jesus' teachings to the church. We got the Gospels, right? And they've got lots of red letter Jesus teaching, but Jesus taught that before his death, before his resurrection, and before the church was established. But then in Revelation, fast forward 70 years after Jesus ascends, and all of a sudden he shows back up again and he gives some red letters to us. And I don't want us to miss them. I don't want us to ignore them. Now, if you read Revelation 2 and 3 in his little 7 letters to the church, like I said earlier, they're like a performance evaluations, if you will. Performance eval. Anybody ever had a performance eval? Show of hands. You can groan as you raise your hand. Okay, if you're too young to be in the workforce, a performance eval is like a progress report or a report card. And basically, it points out 3 things to you, right? It points out to you what you're doing right, what you're doing wrong, and in light of what you're doing wrong, what needs to change. What you're doing right, what you're doing wrong, what needs to change. And have you ever thought about that when it comes to the church? Like the American church? You ever thought, what are we doing right? What are we doing wrong? What needs to change? You ever thought about that when it comes to Northeast Christian Church, your church, those of you who call us your home? What's going right? What's going wrong? What needs to change? I know some of you have, okay? Because there's a lot of times where I'll run into folks in public or I'll get emails or texts or phone calls from friends that are super encouraging. You know, I love this about our church, or I love that about what we did, or I love our Love the Ville DNA. You know, you guys are doing a great job. Lots of folks are so encouraging in our church about what's going right. In the same way, there's lots of folks who will talk to us about what's going wrong in the church. We get lots of emails, and I get lots of notes, and sometimes I run into people after church or in the streets who have no problem telling me the things that they would change about Northeast. Okay, it's funny. You guys know how we did the little survey a couple weeks ago? You guys, who was here for when we did the survey? So about like maybe once a year, we'll do these congregational surveys where we hand out pieces of paper to everybody in the room. There's some demographic information on there, creative thinking on there, and people will fill it out. But there is a select elite group every year who likes to take those surveys, fill them out, and then turn it over to the blank side and write an anonymous letter. Oh, you're so brave. An anonymous, this is maybe too soon because you might be in the room, right? But write an anonymous letter to their pastor about all the things that are going wrong in the church, which is always interesting to me because you don't tell your doctor how to practice medicine, but you tell your pastor how, anyways, so usually we can predict kind of this. I mean, like, we've done enough of these now. We can predict the kind of stuff that people, you know, disagree with us on. And it usually boils down to, like, we don't like how you preach, or we don't like how you guys dress, or we don't like the style of the music, the volume of the music, stuff like that. And that's fine. You can have an opinion on that. It's fine. I'm not mad at you. But let me ask you a question. If Jesus were standing on our stage today and he got to say, hey, Northeast, there's one thing that I really got. There's two things that I really got a problem with at your church. Do you think any of those would make the list? You know what, Northeast? This is Jesus talking. You know what you need to do? You all need to tuck in your shirts. Think that would make the list? If Jesus had audience with the American church today, like, we could broadcast them to all the Christians in our country. You think he'd stand up and he'd say, hey, you listen, church, now listen to me. You know what y'all need to do? You need to bring the hymns back. Now, I'm all for bringing the hymns back. I'm a hymn guy. Trust me. That's what I wrote on the back of my survey. But, you know what comments like that are? Comments like that are what I would call points of preference or matters of opinion. And that's fine. You can have an opinion. You can have a preference. But you need to understand that points of preference are a luxury in the American church that many Christians historically and many Christians around the world and countries that aren't so friendly to Christianity don't have. And I believe that if Jesus were standing on this stage, he probably wouldn't go after points of preference or matters of opinion. You know what he'd go after? He'd go after matters of the heart. In fact, I'll give you a few examples of the things he got after the Revelation churches for. Here's one, Revelation 2:4. He told one church, you guys have lost your first love, your love for Jesus and each other. He told a couple other churches, you guys are tolerating false teachers, like people who are evil, like, and they know they're evil. People who are immoral, and they know they're immoral. People who are liars, and they know they're liars, and you know they're liars. Or here's another one. He goes after another church. He says, you guys are hypocrites. You look alive on the outside, but on the inside, you're dead. These look pretty serious to me, right? So, American church, I'll ask you again. If Jesus were to give us a performance eval today in light of some of this, what do you think he would say? What's right? What's wrong? What do we need to change? Interestingly enough, I don't think we have to wonder all that much. Because there's this one letter he writes to one of the churches. It's the seventh church, the seventh letter he writes, the very end of Revelation chapter 3, that I think was written specifically for us today. In fact, me and one of my friends joke around and we call it the United States of Laodicea. Because you could take the words to this church and almost word for word apply it to us. So I want to study Jesus' words to them because I believe this is our performance eval. All right, pick up with me in Revelation chapter 3, verse 14. This is what Jesus says. He says, John, write this to the church in Laodicea. Tell them, I know all the things that you do, in private and in public. The things you think, the things that you say, the things that you act. There ain't no hiding nothing from me. I'm Jesus. I see all. Tell them I know all. That's chilling enough, right? But tell them, I know all the things they do. And so I know that you guys are neither hot nor cold. I wish you were one or the other. But since you are like lukewarm water, neither hot nor cold, I will spit you out my mouth. Now, quick question. Who would like to be spit out of the mouth of Jesus someday? Yeah, didn't think there was too many hands going to be raised on that one. That's a pretty strong metaphor, right? But you know what? It would have been even stronger for the people of Laodicea than us today. Because the people of Laodicea had this interesting historic situation for them. 1900 years ago in the ancient city of Laodicea, they didn't have a local water supply, right? In fact, they had to pipe water in from 6 miles away. All right, now, whether they got it from a hot water spring or a cold water spring, if you got to pipe something in that kind of ancient technology for 6 miles away, as it travels through the pipes, the water will become tepid, right? It'll become lukewarm, room temperature. It will become the temperature of whatever it is outside. And that's what Jesus is saying right here. He's saying, look, nobody likes to drink lukewarm water. You want your coffee and tea hot? You want your water cold? Hey, when it's cold outside and there's snow on the ground, you don't want lukewarm coffee, do you? You want it hot. Hey, when it's hot outside and it's 100 degrees, you want to crack open a lukewarm Coca-Cola? No, you want it to be cold. And that's what you taste like to me. You taste like a lukewarm Coke on a 95 degree day. That's disgusting, right? That's what he says. That's what he says. Interesting, right? Now, what makes Jesus call them lukewarm? What is so reprehensible about Laodicea that he would spit them out? Well, he goes on. He says, here's what makes you lukewarm. He says, you say, I'm rich. I have everything I want. And I don't need a thing. You know what his problem is with Laodicea? They don't need him. Because they're rich. They got everything they want. And so they don't need a thing. Each one of these three little phrases in the original Greek are different Greek words and different Greek constructions. But each one of those Greek constructions actually points to the same idea. It points to the idea of prosperity, material prosperity. The idea that I've got more than enough material stuff. And Jesus looks at Laodicea and he goes, that's your problem. You have made the God of prosperity the God of your life. You have placed your faith and your hope and your trust in prosperity. And I just want to spit that out. Now he goes on. Check this out. Pick it back up at the top. He says, you say, I am rich. I have everything I want. Don't need a thing. But you don't even realize that you are wretched and miserable, poor, blind, and naked. You are poor, blind, and naked. You are poor, blind, and naked. Now, I highlighted those three because Jesus takes those three and sort of fleshes them out with application points after that. But the reason why Jesus picks these three words is because, again, this would have struck a chord, especially for the people of historic Laodicea. You see, the Laodiceans back then had three points of prosperity, if you will, or public and civic pride. You know what they were? One, Laodicea was a worldwide known banking center. They were the Swiss bankers of antiquity, right? So lots of money flowed in to the city. Lots of money flowed out of the city. They were very, very wealthy, and their standard of living was much higher than other places, right? They thought they were rich, but Jesus says, you're poor. Laodicea, too, was also a medical town. They had one of the most popular med schools of the day back then, some of the most famous med school teachers of the day back then, and they manufactured and produced some of the most famous and potent medicines in all the empire. One of the medicines that they produced was an eye salve made out of Phrygian powder and oil that you could put on your eyes that would help you see better. Jesus says, you think you can see, but really you're blind, right? Third point of pride and prosperity was textiles, cloth. The people of Laodicea, according to one commentator, had access to a breed of sheep that had this really, really desirable black wool. Another commentator said that the people of Laodicea innovated the cool tunic of the day back then. They were fashionistas. Who's into tunics, right? Okay, I don't know. Apparently, that was all the rage back then. What's the rage today? What are people into? I don't know. What is it? Yoga pants, rompers? I don't know. This is what it was. It was like the hipster. You know the hipster hat, right? It's like the hipster hat that doesn't look like a cowboy hat, but also doesn't look like Indiana Jones. It's like a witch hat, but without the crook, right? This is what they were, the fashionistas of the time, and it was a point of prosperity and pride for them. And Jesus looks at all those points of prosperity and he says, I'm so unimpressed. Now, quick sidebar for just a second. You got to understand, Revelation was not written to us, but it was written for us. It was not written to us, but it was written for us. Because you see how he calls out Laodicea? A lot of people like to take Revelation and they like to transplant it and they like to put it on the 21st century without understanding what it meant in the first and second century first. If you don't, you'll miss some important, rich, deep points in the text. Like what he calls out Laodicea for. Now, check this out. I heard one pastor say once that there are three common desires in the human heart, right? That every human experiences, whether you're young or old, rich or poor, man or woman, right? Like whether you're in the East or the West, whether you were born 1,000 years ago or today, there are three common desires that everyone pursues. Joy, significance, and security. In fact, this is what most of us spend most of our lives chasing after, right? Joy, I just want to be happy. Significance, I just want the esteem of others, the love of others, status in the eyes of others, and security. I just want to feel safe, provided for, and cared. There's nothing wrong with that. In fact, I would suggest that God hardwired that into our hearts. Now, the pastor goes on to say, though, the following. He says, wherever you look to for these three things, that's your God. Okay, wherever you go to find your happiness, wherever you go to find your sense of significance, wherever you go to find security and care and provision, that's your God. You know what frustrates Jesus so much about Laodicea? They had made prosperity their God, because that's where they went for their joy. That's where they went for their significance. That's where they went for their security. We got everything we want because we're rich. We don't need anything. And I tell you what, United States of Laodicea, I believe that Jesus would probably say the same thing to us today. This is our performance eval, isn't it? And it's not what's right, it's what's wrong. And something needs to change. Now, can we talk about the false god of prosperity for just a second? Can we talk about it? Okay, let's talk about the god of prosperity, because he has more influence over my life and your life than we would probably ever know. Okay, here's the first thing you need to know. First, being prosperous isn't wrong. Having money isn't wrong. Making a lot of money isn't wrong. Money is actually something, wealth, influence, affluence, like all that is actually something that's morally neutral. What makes wealth wrong is how you get it and what you do with it, right? It's the input and the output at the end of the day. But prosperity in and of itself, it's not like a sinful, inherently sinful thing. And we should thank our lucky stars for that. We should thank God for that, because most of us in this room are pretty prosperous. Just by the nature of you being born in the United States of America means that you're probably, you probably got more prosperity, if you will, material prosperity than most. You've heard statistics like this before. You know that if you make $32,000 or more a year, you're in the top 1% of wage earners on the planet Earth. Isn't that crazy? If you make $17,000 or more a year, you're in the top 5% of wage earners on the planet Earth. Did you know that a third of the world lives on $2 or less a day? It's crazy, right? So we're doing pretty good. Now, the reason why you wouldn't admit that, though, the reason why you wouldn't say, well, I'm pretty prosperous and I'm pretty rich, is because most of us don't feel prosperous or rich. And the reason why we don't feel prosperous or rich is we measure our own prosperity comparatively. You ever notice that? And we usually don't compare ourselves with people who are below us. We compare ourselves with people who are above us, right? Like we look up and we say, well, I got a lot, but they're rich, right? Oh, they're rich, not me. But what if you switch the perspective a little bit? Okay, you know how a lot of us justify our wealth? We've got that story, right? That story in our back pocket of that time when we lived so poor. Oh, I know what it's like to be poor, right? Because way back when, 15 years ago, who's got one of the stories? Come on. I got one. You're about to hear it. Okay. Me and Lindsay, we used to be poor. First year we got married, 2011, it's only 7 years ago. Right? In 2011, we got married. That first year of our marriage, we were poor, y'all. I was a full-time seminarian. I had a part-time job making about $10,000 a year. Lindsay had a job as well. Hers made about $10,000 a year well, so our household income was about $20,000. Now, thank God her job was as a resident director at the undergraduate university where I was a seminarian. Because they offered us free room, free board, and free food. Now, when I say free food, I mean that we got free, unlimited, all-you-can-eat school cafeteria food, as much as we wanted. And by free room and board, I mean that we got a free apartment in a college dormitory that was so decrepit that the year after we moved from Cincy to Louisville, they tore down. Every week, there was a leak in the room. One time, it almost ruined the only valuable possession I had, which was a TV at the time. Like, it was leaking right next to it. I was like, oh. Oh, the heat in this dormitory was actually powered by a boiler unit. Anybody ever heard a boiler unit kick on? Yeah, so every year, during the winter time, at about 2 a.m. in the morning, it would go. And we thought, the apocalypse is happening, or the boiler's coming on. Not sure, right? But that's what it sounded like. Did I mention that it was in a dormitory? So college kids are making noises and doing things at all hours of the day. Lindsay and I, we both had cars, but they were beater cars. My car was, it had 200,000 plus miles on it. Her car was 1 year away from death, as we would find out the next year. And we only had enough discretionary spending money to go out to eat once a week. And that was kind of our date night. You know where we went? Skyline. Skyline Chili. Because you could do it for less than $10, right? And we were, you know, we were in our early 20s, so it didn't, you know what I'm saying? We weren't thinking about that then. Three conies, side of fries, chili on the noodles, less than 10. If we were feeling really frisky, we'd get a Coke, you know, and share it when the waitress wasn't looking. But see, anyways, that was us. That was us. Now check this out. We were so poor back then. And if us then could have seen us today, we would look at us today and say, whoa, they are rich. But I'll tell you this, if the 2011 us could get on an airplane and travel to a developing part of the world and tell them all about our financial pressures, you know what response we may get from them? They might say to us, well, okay, 2011, Tyler and Lindsay, I heard you say that you have as much food as you want, 3 meals a day. I heard you say that you have a shelter over your head that protects you from the elements with heat and air conditioning. I heard you say that you had 2 cars that would get you from A to B, 2 jobs that were pretty good jobs that you like and were secure. And I also heard you say that you had enough discretionary spending money to go out to eat once a week. Wow. You're rich. Right? You get what I'm getting at here, y'all? Most of us are doing okay. Right? We're pretty prosperous. And it's something to feel guilty about. All right? Being prosperous isn't wrong. But you know what is wrong? Worshiping prosperity. And some of us do. Now, here's how you know if you worship prosperity. Jesus tells us, 3:17 and 18. He says, here's how you know. You say I am rich, but you don't realize that you are poor. How do you know? How do you know that you are worshiping the false god of prosperity? You say you're rich, but you are poor. You are both rich and poor at the same time. And Jesus says you don't even realize it. This is what the God of prosperity will do to you. He will make you superficially rich and spiritually poor at the same time. He will make you materially rich and emotionally and relationally poor at the same time. Okay, you ever notice how he does this, right? Okay, you ever notice how the God of prosperity will like swing you back and forth between these two realities? I got everything I need. But man, I need more. I got everything I need, but man, I need more. Oh man, I got everything I need. Look at this nice, new, big house, exactly where I wanted it to be located. But now that I've lived in it for a few months, there's a few things that need to be done in the inside of the kitchen, in the bathroom, in the closet, okay? I got everything I need. Look at this nice, beautiful, luxury car. But now that I've lived in it for a couple months, there's a little mark on the side of it because somebody left their grocery cart out in the parking lot of the grocery store, right? And those people, right? So I need something better, right? I have everything I need. But I need more. You ever notice how he just kind of dangles us? He's a tricky God, isn't he? Okay, you ever notice how the prosperity God is always hungry, but he's never full? He's just always like, feed me, feed me, feed me, feed me, feed me. And so we do. Because when we feed him, it satisfies us for the moment. We go to bed with a full stomach. Then we wake up the next morning hungry again for more. Okay, and I don't blame us. I don't blame us for feeding him. I don't. Because it does feel good in the moment, right? He gives you what you want in the moment, that satisfaction you want in the moment. I mean, come on, y'all. That vacation is real right now in that moment. That car is real right here in the moment. Those season tickets are real. That 401k is real right, in the moment. But it can only provide you that momentary satisfaction because all of a sudden you want more, you want more. He's hungry all over again. How about this? Here are the two great lies that the prosperity God never wants you to find out about him. Sure, he'll make you rich, but he will always leave you discontent and self-destructive. You ever notice that about him? Oh man, he gives, but then he discontents and destroys. Okay, we'll start off with a light example here. Most of us can identify with this. Guys, you wake up at like 6:15 in the morning, right? You go get your coffee, brush your teeth, get ready for work. Takes you about 10 minutes because you're a guy. But then all of a sudden you look at your watch and it's 6:30 and your wife hasn't left. You know if she don't get out the door by 6:30, she's going to be late for work. So you go into the room, you're like, honey, are you okay? And all of a sudden you hear a growl, a snarl come out of the closet. It's more like it's a snort, you know. You know, like it's coming out of the closet. So you go in the closet and you see everything is everywhere in the closet. There's like, you know, outfits all over the floor, shoes everywhere. And your wife's standing in front of the mirror going like this. And you look at her and you're like, honey, what's wrong? Bad question. But honey, what's wrong? And she says, what do you mean? What's wrong? Isn't it obvious? I don't have anything to wear. And you're like, honey, you got 15 outfits on the floor. Again, bad response. Been there, right? Now, okay, yeah, we laugh. It's a joke, you know, and it's kind of a light example. But you know what that is? That's the God of prosperity. He gives to us, then he discontents us, and he destroys us. You ever notice how we can get that promotion, right? That promotion that we always wanted. And when we get it, we feel good. We're on top of the world. We think about, look at all those people I pushed beneath me because I am that good, right? Feels good for the moment. Then all of a sudden, a few months later, you stop looking down and you start looking up again. And you notice there's a whole nother level of success or a whole nother level of fame above you. And now you want that instead of being satisfied with this. You know what that is? That's the God of prosperity. And man, he loves to do that to us. He loves to give to us and then discontent us and destroy us. Hey, you ever wonder why so many famous people, celebrities, you know, successful folks can be so anxious or depressed or even suicidal sometimes? It's because they figure out what very few of us ever will. They figure out that achieving your dreams isn't always as dreamy as you thought it was. It doesn't deliver that apocalyptic satisfaction that you were hoping for. You know what that is? It's God of prosperity. He gives to you. For some of us, he'll take you all the way to the top. And even at the top, he'll discontent you and destroy you. You ever noticed how it doesn't matter how much money you make? In fact, okay, the more money you make and the more money you save, the more focused and worried and anxious you are about your money. You think it'd be the opposite. Like you get more and you save more and all of a sudden you become less anxious and less focused and less worried about it. But it's not, right? You just get more consumed by it. What is that? It's the God of prosperity. He's just doing what he do. He gives to you, discontents you, and destroys you. Okay, let me ask you this. Do any of these describe you? Because this is how you know he's got you. You hate your job, but you can't quit it. Because if you quit it, you wouldn't be able to afford your lifestyle anymore. Your household income is about 150K. But it feels like a third of that because you're so crushed by debt. You spend 2 hours a day in rush hour construction traffic to get to that job that allows you to afford that massive dream house that you never spend time in because you spend 2 hours a day in rush hour construction traffic getting back and forth from your job. Your 30-year-old kids move halfway across the country because staying closer to you means making less money, and it hurts you to know that. But you can't say anything to them because you taught them to live that way. Or how about this one? You live a prosperous life with more than enough, But then you throw your hands up constantly in anger and disappointment at God because he doesn't provide for all those kids in the villain around the world who don't have enough. Hey, look, if that's you, and man, sometimes that can be me, if that's you, Jesus called it. He called it. He said, man, you'll be rich, but you will also be poor if you worship prosperity. And he's a tricky God, so he'll do it to you without you even noticing. Yeah, there's this passage in Revelation 9 that I noticed this time, really for the first time, and I've read Revelation many, many times. And it was a chilling passage. It describes this image of hell, really. Hell on earth, I believe. Because it's this picture of punishment. All these plagues and all these punishments fall on the disobedient people of the world. And people are suffering. People are being destroyed. People die. And then finally, the punishments stop. And everybody's not killed, right? Some folks survive. And the assumption of the passage is that the folks that do survive realize that the reason why everyone got punished was because they were disobedient to God, and they now have an opportunity to repent. But you know what these folks do in Revelation 9? It's chilling. Revelation 9:20. It says, the remaining men and women who weren't killed by the plagues went on their merry way. Wow. They didn't change their life. They didn't quit worshiping demons. They didn't quit centering their lives around lumps of gold and silver and brass, hunks of stone and wood that can't see, hear, or move. No, there wasn't a sign. Change of heart. They just plunged right on into their murderous, occult, promiscuous, and thieving ways. Now look, y'all, that's hell. That is hell on earth. Knowing something that is destroying you, you can't pull away from. Being destroyed by something that you can't detach yourself from. And you hate it. You hate it. You hate it about you that you can't pull yourself away from it. But you're stuck. It's almost like you're in too deep, right? Because there's been times before where you've turned around and you've tried to look back and see the light at the beginning of the tunnel that you walked in so many years ago, but you can't see it anymore because you're too far in. Just feels like there's no way out. If that's you, with the God of prosperity, Jesus speaks a better word. Because you know what he tells the church in Laodicea? Revelation 3:20. He says, there is a way out. Because look, I stand at the door right now. And I knock. And if you just hear my voice and open the door, I'll come in. I'll come in. We can share a meal together as friends. I'll come in. But if you let me in, I just want to warn you. I'm going to ask of you a few things. I'm going to ask you to buy gold from me. I'm going to ask you to put on my white garments. I'm going to ask you to put my ointment in your eyes so you'll be able to see. I'm going to ask you to look to me. Basically, you know what Jesus says here? He says the solution to prosperity isn't less prosperity, it's more Jesus. The question is which one do you really want today? Jesus or prosperity? More Jesus or more prosperity? You got to get honest with yourself. Hey, for those of you who want to get honest with yourself, I want you to take these four questions home this week. And I want you to think through them. All right, first question is this. Who really has my heart? Jesus or prosperity? And that sounds kind of like a fluffy question, but it's not. I want you to go home. I want you to take those three common desires of the human heart, and I want to ask you, where do I look for my joy? Where do I look for my significance? Where do I look for my security? Because Jesus has radically different definitions of what brings joy, what brings significance, and what brings security in life than we do. Who really has my heart? Here's the second question. Have I made a plan to get out? Or do I just feel bad? Because I know a sermon like this will create some holy discontent in your heart. It will create conviction. But repentance and conviction are two very, very different things, right? And Jesus wants, he wants fruit on the tree. So where are you at today? Some of you are being crushed by the God of prosperity. Some of you are addicted, okay? You've gotten woke to that. Good. Now, have you made a plan, or will you make a plan to get out? Here's the third question I'd ask you. Have you ever put a dollar sign on enough? Just go home and think about that this week. Because here's what most of us tend to do. Most of us, as we get older, our financial earnings increase, right? And good for you. God's blessing. Oh, great, right? But as our financial earnings increase, you know what we tend to do? We tend to allow our standard of living to pace right with our financial earnings. And so my question for you is this: at what point are you just going to take your standard of living and say, enough, enough, praise God, that's enough? And as your earnings continue to increase, you say, God, the rest is yours. It's yours. What point? Fourth question I'd ask you to consider is, have you set some bold giving goals? Because see, God likes, when you give yourself to Jesus, he will turn your prosperity into generosity. He does every time. So have you set for yourself some giving goals, some giving percentages? You have a savings percentage that comes out of your paycheck every month. You know how much is going to savings. Some of you have budgets where you have a line item for shopping, a line item for, you know, restaurants, a line item for your, you know, car payment and your house payment and all that. And that's good. That's fine. My question is there a line item for generosity that comes out every month and that you get out of your hands and into God's control? Because if there's not, I would tell you that you may have your priorities out of whack. So who has my heart? Have I made a plan to get out? Have I put a dollar sign on enough? And have I set some bold giving goals? I challenge you, go home this week and consider. All right, let me close by saying this. You know what Jesus wants at the end of the day? He didn't want your money, he wants your heart. Where your treasure is, there your heart will also be. That's what Jesus said once, right? So he knows that wherever your treasure goes, there your heart will be. That's why he talks about your money. You know what any God wants? Any God just wants your trust. The God of prosperity wants your trust, so does Jesus. There's this one time in Luke 6, Jesus said, blessed are the poor, blessed are the hungry, blessed are those who are suffering and weeping and in despair, and blessed are those who are persecuted, hated, and cut off. It's weird that he says that, right? Isn't that counterintuitive? Because in our culture today, when we say I'm hashtag blessed, it's usually not because we're hungry or poor, right? It's because we have health, wealth, and prosperity. But Jesus flips the script here and he says, no, actually blessed are they. And you know why he says that? It's almost an embarrassing passage to show my non-Christian friends because it just seems kind of weird, right? But you know why he says that? Because in each one of these four situations, you know what you experience. You know what you experience when you're so poor, you don't know where your next paycheck is coming from. You know what you experience when you're so hungry, you don't know where your next meal is coming from, or you're so distraught and beat down, or so persecuted and cut off from others. You know what you experience? You experience this moment where you hit your knees and you go, God, I've got no control over this, and so I need your help. Jesus says, blessed are you when you're right here. You know what Jesus wants? He wants you right here when the going gets tough, but he also wants you right here, when your life is full of prosperity as well, when it's bad and when it's good. So look, there's a throne on your heart. You get to choose what sits on that throne. What will you choose? Prosperity or Jesus? I pray you'll choose Jesus, because he's the only one writing checks that you can cash anyways. Let me pray for you. God, let us choose Jesus. Let us be a church that is a beacon of generosity, because there's nothing more powerful in the world than a generous church. And let us be people who fall deeply in love with you and your son and his ways, so that we might control and leverage all the blessing that you've given us for your ends and your ways and your will in the world. We're so blessed. We thank you for that. In Jesus' name, amen.